The Spirit is warning us that in the latter times, there are going to be false doctrines and deceiving spirits. Peter warns us, knowing this verse, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts. There's plenty of scoffers today. Paul warns us, know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. This brutal list all starts with one thing. Men will be lovers of themselves, meaning they're putting themselves above all others. And then, because of that, everything flows from it. So Paul warns us, Jude warns us. I want to remind you, though you once knew this, that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe, and the angels who did not keep their proper domain, but left their own abode. He has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day, as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, in a similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. These grumblers, complainers, walking according to their own lusts, and they mouth great swelling words, flattering people to gain advantage. But you, beloved, remember the words which were spoken to you by the apostle of our Lord Jesus Christ, how they told you that there would be mockers in the last time who would walk according to their own ungodly lusts. These are sensual persons who cause division, not having the Spirit. It's just like warning after warning after warning of how bad things are going to get. Now, we might have had this sort of naive view, which I once had, that things are going to get better and better and better and better, and so that by the time Jesus comes, you know, there'll be a lot of people turning to the Lord. That's not the picture the New Testament gives. John warns us, little children, it is the last hour, and as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come, by which we know that it is the last hour. Who is a liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? He is the Antichrist, who denies the Father and the Son. Whoever denies the Son does not have the Father either. He who acknowledges the Son has the Father also. Do people deny that Jesus is the Christ today? All the time? Even Jesus warns us, Jesus himself. And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilence, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will offend. They will betray one another and will hate one another. And then many false prophets will arise and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. He says, of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as in the days of Noah were, so also were the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. When we get to Luke 21, we're going to see this in a more complete picture, because Jesus is warning of multiple things happening, and we sometimes get them jumbled up. But the bottom line is, just like in the days of Noah, so it will be when Jesus comes again. Just like in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah, when fire and brimstone came down from heaven, so it will be. Just like at the destruction of Jerusalem, so it's going to be at the end. In other words, it's just going to be sudden, irreversible, and devastating. This is going to be like that. There's going to be no time at that point to change. That's why we have to be alert. And that's why we have to be awake and aware and watchful. Because the time of his return is unknown. So be watchful. The time of his return is unknown. And secondly, be faithful, because the time of his return will be unexpected. And that is what he's trying to explain here. Look at verse 41. Chapter 12 and verse 41. Then Peter said, "Lord, do you speak this parable only to us or to all people?" And Jesus answers with another parable. And the Lord said, "Who then is that faithful and wise servant whom his master will make ruler over his household to give them the portion of their food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will make him ruler over all that he has." He wants us to be ready. He wants us to be watching and faithful in our service. And I want you to notice the word that he uses. He uses the word doing. Look at there in verse 42. Verse 43. "Blessed is that servant whom the master will find so doing when he comes." There's a time for learning, and we know that. We are to be students of the Scripture. And there's a time for feeling. We like to talk about our feelings. There's a time for talking. The problem is we get stuck in those places. We may get stuck in learning and never doing. We may be stuck in our feelings. We're feeling, but we're not doing. And we may be stuck in our talking, and we're good at talking, but what does Jesus say? "Blessed is the servant whom his master will find talking when he comes." Blessed is that servant whom master will find, no, doing. Doing is the active word here. We're not to be just learning and talking and feeling, or being stuck in that place. The wise and faithful servants will be actually doing his will. You think of that when Jesus said, you know, many will say to me, "Lord, Lord, didn't we do all these things?" You know, and they're trying to impress on Jesus that they should be saved. And he says, "I don't know you. Depart from me, you who work lawlessness." And so what happens is people start doing things, but they think that by doing that, that somehow is doing the Lord's will, when maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So we've got to be watchful of that, you know, like just wearing a Jesus t-shirt. Is that what we're going to tell Jesus on the, I wore a Jesus t-shirt. I had a Jesus bumper sticker, and I sent Bible verses on social media. Is that what's going to get me into heaven? He says, "Those who do the will of my Father in heaven." That's the wise and faithful servant. And then there's the unwise and the unfaithful servant in verse 45. "But if a servant says in his heart, 'My master is delaying in his coming,' and begins to beat the male and female servants and to eat and drink and be drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him and at an hour when he's not aware and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. That word, cut him in two, is the New King James. Cut asunder is the King James. Cut to pieces is the ESV. The master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, at an hour when he is not aware, and he will cut him to pieces and appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. That is a metaphorical phrase. It means to punish with terrible severity. That's what that means. It goes back to the ancient times when, like in the book of Daniel, a king would literally cut someone to pieces. Or in the parable of the man forgiven so much, he was taken and delivered to the torturers until he could pay every last penny. It's a metaphorical term that means to be punished with terrible severity. That's the judgment. So in this passage here, this unwise servant, he makes two mistakes. Number one, the first mistake is, I'm going to do what I want while the master is away. That was the first mistake. I'm going to just do whatever I want. I'm just going to beat the male and female servants. I'm just going to drink. I'm just going to get drunk. I'm just going to party. And I'm just going to do that while the master is away. And the reason this can happen is because we compartmentalize our faith. I told you about the truck I used to drive. It didn't have a gas gauge that worked. And so I would have to go off a mileage, right? And so I would drive, and I would have to be aware that at some point I was going to have to get gas at a certain mileage. But what would happen was I compartmentalized that. And I'd just be, you know, cruising along, not paying attention. And one time, Emily and I are coming to a church kind of potluck kind of thing, and I run out of gas at the top of the hill right here between Merlin and the second Grants Pass exit. I literally run out of gas at 50 miles an hour, 55 miles an hour. I stick it in neutral real fast, and I'm coasting at this point. And I'm supposed to be meeting the brethren, and I'm running out of gas, which means I'm going to have to call somebody and tell them, I ran out of gas, I'm on the freeway, can someone come pick me up? Very embarrassing. So somehow I had enough momentum to where we were able to coast on to the off-ramp, down to the stoplight. I turned right into the gas station, and I pulled right up to the pump, and it stopped. And I told Emily, please don't ever do this. I know I just did this, but you don't ever want to do this. Don't ever run out of gas like that. What was happening? I had compartmentalized that. It was like back there somewhere in a compartment that I'd tucked away in a box, right? I wasn't thinking about it until all of a sudden, it's not in the box anymore. It's not in the compartment anymore. It's now real. It's now happening. It's now in real time. I'm out of gas. And this can happen in our faith. We compartmentalize our spirituality to Sunday. And then during the week, we just do what we want. But what happens is, eventually doing that, you run out of gas by compartmentalizing. So this guy, I'll do what I want while my master is away, was his first mistake. And secondly, his second mistake, I have plenty of time to put things right before my master returns. In other words, I've got all the time in the world. And when I think the master returns, then I'll get everything straightened out. That's kind of the mistake that he's making here. So he says in his heart, my master is delayed in his coming, and so he mistreats other people. He starts mistreating. Think about mistreating other people in the church. Think about mistreating your spouse. And now he wants to enjoy the pleasures of the world. He's even getting drunk and becoming intoxicated. I heard recently about a preacher, and I don't know where he preached, a denomination of some sort, but he had an affair. He left his wife for another woman, and he was still preaching. And when it all came to light and everything came crashing down, he was asked about it later. And he said, I was preaching, but I wasn't praying. He said he had stopped praying 5 years before. Think about that for a moment. He had stopped praying 5 years prior to his fall. He lasted quite a while, but it caught up to him. And some people say attendance is like a barometer of faithfulness. But I remember Jim once saying it's prayer. Prayer is a barometer. It's a measurement of where our faith is, where it's at. This guy had stopped. He'd still been going to church. He'd still been preaching. He stopped praying. And it led to his downfall. He drifted, is what it amounts to. When you stop praying, you're drifting. He drifted into the rocks of reality. And this, of course, this brings the judgment. Verse 46. But if that servant says in his heart, my master is delayed in his coming, and begins to beat the male and female servants to eat and drink and be drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, at an hour when he is not aware, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. And that servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself or do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes. But he who did not know, yet committed things deserving of stripes, will be beaten with few. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. And to whom much has been committed, of him they will ask the more. This is a difficult passage. We talked about to be cut in two. That language is just to be punished with terrible severity. There's a judgment day coming. That's the whole point, is to be watchful and ready. It will be sudden, unexpected, and irreversible. Now, what does Jesus mean when he says some people will be whipped with lesser, and some will be punished with greater? I wished I knew the answer to that question. I don't know exactly what he means, except that we know in James 3, verse 1, there is a stricter judgment. Because James says, let not many of you become teachers, for you will receive a stricter judgment. So how that plays out, I don't know. It almost sounds like some people are more ignorant of what they're supposed to be doing, and they'll be punished less. And other people are not ignorant, and they'll be punished more. I mean, it does sound that way, if that's what that means. But let's also remember something. I don't know what that means, but I do know this. There is no such thing as absolute moral ignorance. There is no such thing, except for a child before the age of accountability. Outside of that, there is no such thing as absolute moral ignorance. Our own God-given conscience convicts us of right and wrong. And so, really, our willful ignorance is actually a part of our sin. So to claim ignorance doesn't actually get anybody off, because our ignorance is a part of our sin. As for the judgment of God, God knows all things. He knows the heart. And because he's God, he can't make a mistake. So that's one thing that I'm thankful for. God is too wise to make a mistake, and too good to do wrong. One preacher, L.S. White, used to say it. God is too wise to make a mistake and too good to do wrong. So sometimes we spin out on, you know, what's the fair judgment of this person or that person on the day of judgment. God's not going to make any mistakes on that day. You can rest assured that no one's going to sneak into heaven that's not supposed to be there, and no one's going to go to hell who was supposed to be in heaven. God is too wise to make a mistake. He's too good to do wrong. But there is a principle here. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required, and to whom much has been committed, of him they will ask the more. In other words, those who are faithful in little will be faithful in much. And this is a responsibility to wise and faithful servants. We do have a responsibility. We can't just claim ignorance. We need to be watchful because the time of his return is unknown. We need to be faithful because the time of his return will be unexpected. And we need to be ready because he can appear or our life could end at any time. That is his point. Verse 40, therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. If we're to just look at a couple points here, number one, what we do here and now has significance for all eternity. I think that's a major point of this passage. Let your waist be girded and your lamps burning, and you yourselves will be like men who wait for their master when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. There are times when we drift in our faith and we're kind of on cruise control. That does happen. I've been there. And it's so easy. It can happen so easy, right? It's as easy as falling asleep. That's what's scary about it. We have to always be ready and keep our lamp lit and burning bright. And really, this is just it's a call to action to get serious. It's about getting serious with our faith and staying spiritually awake. Paul says, "And do this, knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. For now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore let us cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts." So there's this urgency that we're being called to, that we are living in perilous times. We need to be ready. We want the Lord to find us ready, is what we want. I mean, do we really, since no one knows the day or the time of Jesus' return, and no one knows the day or the time of their own death, we have to be ready at all times. I mean, all of life must be a preparation for that day. And do you really want the Lord arriving when you're arguing with your spouse? I mean, is that really what you want the Lord to find? You can't get along with your own spouse. Is that really what you want the Lord to find there? Or you're just full of envy and strife, and there's just this constant drama and conflict, or you're preoccupied and distracted, or you refuse to forgive, and you refuse to serve. Is that what you want the Lord to find? Absolutely not. Is there somebody you need to apologize to, maybe? Is there somebody you need to get things right with? Maybe there's been a falling out. Well, now is the time to get that straightened out. You don't want to put that off. I remember Jim used to say, you know, sometimes we don't want to go to God for forgiveness because we know we've asked for forgiveness for that same thing too many times to count. And to go to God again is to just make him mad, and therefore we don't want to go to God and ask for forgiveness. And so we put it off, and so we put it off, so 2 weeks turns into 2 months, and then 2 months turns into 2 years. Just take care of it now. Just go to him now. He wants you to get right with him. But to put it off just makes it harder sometimes. And it's the same thing with an apology to a spouse or to a loved one. We put it off, but then that time never comes, and then we never reconcile that relationship that we should just... There's a time to apologize and get things right. But the most important thing is to get things right with God. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly, for it will come as a snare on all who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. There are generations that had it harder, I think. This generation that Jesus is talking to in Luke 21, they were going to get hit hard, those that were in Jerusalem, because the city was going to be destroyed by the Romans. And so the Lord wanted them ready. He wants to find us ready. You could use this word earnest. It means dedication. It means intense desire. Therefore, we must give the more earnest heed to the things we have heard, lest we drift away. So we want to be earnest in the study of his word. We want to be earnest in prayer, continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. We want to be earnest in love, but earnestly desire the best gifts, and yet I will show you a more excellent way. That's the last verse of 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Well, 1 Corinthians 13, he shows the better way to be earnest in love. And that's going to require times where we're going to need to go to our brethren and make things right out of love. I just want to bring out, baptism is the beginning of our new life. So these are being earnest in our commitment. It means being intentional with our faith, not drifting, so that, you know, not like Adam in the Garden of Eden, where he's just standing there while Eve takes the temptation from the enemy and she offers him, here's the fruit, why don't you eat? Well, what's Adam doing? He's standing right there. He didn't have an intentional faith. He's just being passive. And he's just drifting right into it. And that's kind of how it works. But I just want to end on this one point. Look at this wonderful king that we serve. Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat, and he will come and will come and serve them. There's this turn of events in this passage. He's talking about the servants being ready for when the master returns from the wedding, that they can open the door. Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them. I couldn't understand what this meant. There's a reversal here of roles. Now the servants are being served. How fascinating is that? I couldn't make sense of it until Russ and I were talking. And it dawned on me that what happened with the prodigal son? The prodigal son, he's gone off and he left his father and he's wasted all the inheritance on just riotous living, partying. And he basically partied the money away. And then he realizes when a famine hits what he'd done. And he says, I want to return. I want to make things right. But he says, I can't return as a son. I'll go back and I'll just say, I have sinned, Father, against you and before heaven. And I'm not worthy to be your son anymore. Just let me be a servant. That's all I want to be. Let me just be a servant. And you know what happens. But the father said to his servants, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Now who's serving who? The son just wants to come back and just be a servant. And the father says, you're my son. Put a robe on him. Put a ring on him. Kill a fatted calf. We're going to celebrate. And now, the father is actually serving the son in this amazing turn of events. We have such an amazing master, such an amazing king, that his grace towards us is not what we deserved. Jesus didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. He actually left the glory of heaven to become a servant. And he ends up washing the feet of the disciples the night before they leave, before they deny him. He's going to wash their feet. We serve a wonderful king. Be watchful because the time of his return is unknown. Be faithful because the time of his return will be unexpected. And be ready because he can appear or our life could end at any time. That's, I think, what the prodigal son realized. That this was unsustainable. There comes a point where we just have to realize it is unsustainable to live without God. We just can't. We need him. Peter says, therefore, with minds that are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. This is that Greek that is translated, gird up the loins of your mind. But in the NIV, with minds that are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. The song has been chosen, and the song is All Things Are Ready. Isn't that interesting that all things are ready, and yet he's wanting us to be ready? Because this is going to be a big day. And the reason it's going to be a big day in part was it's going to end everything in this time and space. But also, it's not going to have time to make the news. It's not going to have time for people to debate it on cable TV. It's not going to be none of that. When the end comes, it's going to be over. It's going to be sudden and irreversible. And there'll be no debating. There'll be nobody, you know, scoffing. It's just going to be done and over. And then every knee is going to bow. Every tongue is going to confess that Jesus is Lord. Not because they have to, but because it'll be so overwhelming. The truth will be so overwhelming. They won't be able to help it. If we can help in any way, please let it be known as we stand and sing.
All things are ready. Come to the feast. Come, for the table now is spread. Ye famishing, ye weary, come, and thou shalt be richly fed.